Welcome to the Philia podcast. Philia means daughter. We are the daughters of the women who came before us, and we fight so that our daughters may be free. We are a women-led volunteer organization. Our vision is a world free from patriarchy, where all women and girls are liberated. We seek to contribute to the women's liberation movement by building sisterhood and solidarity among women, locally, nationally, and globally. By amplifying the voices of women, particularly those less often heard or purposefully silenced, and by defending women's human rights. Our podcast seeks to shed light on some of the most pressing issues facing women and girls around the world. Please take from them what you can. In sisterhood and in solidarity, the Philia team. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Philia podcast. My name is Raquel Rosario Sanchez, and I'm a spokeswoman for Philia. Today, we are delighted to speak with Jo Phoenix. Jo Phoenix is the chair in criminology at the Open University, and she has been a jobbing academic for nearly 24 years. She is a trustee at the Center for Crime and Justice Studies. She researches violence against women, prostitution, child sexual exploitation, sex, gender, and justice and youth justice. She writes on ethics, politics, and professionalism in academia. Her research interests include all of the above, and that has meant that she has studied and written about a wide variety of subjects, including managerialism and ethics in the production of criminological knowledge, prostitution, prostitution policy reform, child sexual exploitation, sex and its regulations, youth penalty, and youth justice practice and policy. Jo, as I have just mentioned, your academic interest and your work is very broad. Indeed. But for a lot of people who will be listening to this podcast, they will be associating you with something a little different or very peculiar. And I want us to delve into it. But first of all, how are you?
Today, I'm very well. It's been probably the rockiest that I've had in my professional career. And as you said, you know, I've been at this nearly 2.5 decades. And yet things have happened in the last 3 months. Well, since May the 18th of this year, and preceding that since December the 5th of 2019, things have happened that I, honest to goodness, never thought would happen. How am I? I'm good and in a reflexive place, if you like, trying to figure out how on earth I ended up at the center of such a media storm.
Yes. But let's, before we get into the media storm, let's go back to the very beginning. You are an academic, you specialize in criminology, and you are at the Open University doing your job, right?
Yes.
You receive an invitation from the Center for Criminology, along with the Department of Sociology at the University of Essex. Yep. And this is an invitation to give a talk on the 5th of December, 2019. Eventually, that talk was titled Trans Rights and Justice: Complicated Contours in Contemporary Sex, Gender, and Sexualities Politics. Yes. You received the invitation from those two, the center and the department, those academic center and departments. What was your initial reaction?
When I very first began 2.5 decades ago, I was a young lecturer at Middlesex University, and Professor Nigel South, who at that point in 2019 was the head of the Center for Criminology, he and I go back a very, very long time. And of course, within criminology, it's fairly standard practice that we offer invitations to, you know, other academics who are doing research to come and talk about their research. So the actual original invitation was in 2018. And for that, I was going to talk about prostitution policy reform and why, even when we're talking about child sexual exploitation, we still need to talk about prostitution. But sadly, I was unable to give that particular seminar because that morning I'd been involved in an accident and had to spend the most of the day in hospital. So the December the 5th, 2019 invitation was, if you like, making good on the previous invitation. But by 2019, my own research interests had moved on. So by 2019, I was involved as an expert, if you like, in analyzing issues of gender in the context of prisons with a collaborator at the University of Newfoundland. And so what I wanted to talk about in the December was about some of that new research. And of course, you know, one of the things that was coming up from the field work that had been done in Canada was that actually how we think about trans rights and how we enact them, if you like, in the context of prisons was riddled with all sorts of complications and contradictions. And, you know, generally there were just a lot of problems, if you like, with how we cater for trans individuals in the context of prisons. So I offered that as a talk to the University of Essex, and they said, yes, please come along.
You offered this as a talk?
Yeah. Yeah, I offered it as a talk. Yeah, and they said yes. We agreed the title in the September of 2019, and they started advertising the talk on Twitter and other places in the September of 2019. And everything was just hunky-dory, basically. You know, I did explain to them that this was a controversial area, and they duly noted that. But, you know, it looked like everything was just going ahead fine by the time we got to the first week of December.
Hold on one second. At that point, how involved or how much did you knew about the ongoing debate about sex and gender that was going on?
Well, this is where, Raquel, we have to go back 2.5 decades, right? I have been involved in research on sex, gender, and justice of one variety or another for the entirety of my academic career. I cut my teeth. I got my PhD doing field work in the area of prostitution. And I was, if you like, I'm not on camera, so you can't see it. I've got rabbit ears going on here. So, you know, I am known for the fact that I often offer both and type analyses. So, you know, women involved in sex work are often both exploited and, you know, kind of working in inverted commas. So I go back a long time in this. And of course, I keep my eye on the debates and the politics. And my entry, if you like, into the very contested areas of trans and, well, gender identity, shall we say, and feminism was over the course of the summer in 2019, when I signed the two infamous letters that Kathleen Stock put together in the Sunday Times and in The Guardian, in which we, a group of academics in particular, were expressing concern about Stonewall's undue influence in the academic arena, or more specifically, Stonewall's insistence that no debate can take place about the shape of trans rights, i.e., you know, self-identification, that was going to have a, quote, chilling effect on academic research. So I was there from that beginning stuff. And then in the October of that year, of 2019, I gave a talk for Women's Place UK in Leicester. And in that talk, I put it on the table, if you like, that actually trans rights in the context of prison need some very careful thought. Very careful thought. That now, that's not to say that trans individuals shouldn't have rights. I absolutely fully support trans rights, but women's prisons are very specific contexts. So, you know, self-identification for a trans individual into a female prison is not without its problems. So how aware was I about the contested nature? Pretty aware. You know, I didn't do this blindly. I wasn't an accidental bystander in this. I wanted to be able to talk about how difficult it had become to talk about these issues.
And it sounds from what you were saying that the people who, the academics who contacted you with this invitation, they were also aware.
I don't know. I mean, I made them aware. Do you know what I mean? But, you know, how much
they
people
didn't
take
know, didn't they need?
Well, I certainly, by the time we got to the end of November, beginning of December, I think that the academics in the Center for Criminology had some indication because I had been asked by, I think it was Nigel, it was somebody, I'm not sure who, whether I was going to give, quote, just another TERF talk. Now, I was insulted by that email, I have to say, and I sent back an email saying no, that, you know, I was going to give an academic talk. So, yeah, I think they grew to know. And certainly by the time we got to about December the 4th, boy, did they know.
So at that point, December 4th, you're out to give your talk. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us what happened on that day?
Yeah. So December the 4th is the night before. So it was either the night before or very early on the morning of December the 5th. I can't remember exactly which. I was informed by one of the academics at the Center for Criminology that there had been some Twitter activity and that activity was negative, if you like. Now, by the time we got to 8 o'clock in the morning of December the 5th, in fact, let me just interrupt my own story here for a little second. On the morning of December the 5th, I woke up in Leicester. Leicester is nearly 5 hours away from Wivenhoe, where the University of Essex is. I was driving to give that talk. So I needed to leave by, I think I'd worked out like 11:30 in the morning in order to get there for the 4 o'clock start. So for
you
me,
far out, 5 hours.
I didn't actually drive in the end, and I'll tell you why. So, but yeah, and that's not unusual. You know, I would rather drive to go give a talk, depending on where it is, than take, you know, a train, because sometimes the trains are actually problematic. Plus, I have a disability, which makes it a little bit more difficult sometimes.
But
anyway.
But your organizers knew what they were asking of you when they invited you then.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's fine. You know, it's, you know, I've given a talk in, you know, Hobart, Tasmania, you know, and flown halfway around the world just to give a talk. So it's not unusual in my world to travel to give these talks. So and in fact, the talk that I was due to give at Essex, I'd given in St. John's, Newfoundland only a month previously in Canada. Right. So we get to the morning and it's clear that there's some Twitter campaigning starting. And in fact, there was one, I was made aware of a tweet by Matt Lauder, who is an academic and historian, in fact, so nothing to do with criminology, basically putting up a quote unquote bat signal to get people to pile in and quote, ask tough questions. Now, this particular individual had also done a running tweet commentary thread on my WP UK talk, and it was an absolute bad faith reading of that WP UK talk, and he accused me of mendacity and all sorts of, you know, all sorts of hideousness, transphobia, etc. And that tweet thread was gathering a lot of energy within the university amongst academics and amongst student populations. So by the time we get to 9 in the morning, Nigel, the colleague that I've known for, you know, feels like centuries, for a very long time, was contacting me via, I think it was either WhatsApp or email, I can't remember which, saying that students were threatening to blockade the sociology department or boycott the sociology department if I appeared on campus. And then by 10 o'clock in the morning, the messages coming from Essex were that students were threatening to barricade the entrance. Now, I never knew whether that was the entrance to the university or the entrance to the room in which I was going to speak. Now, whilst all of this was going on, this was around the time that Julie Bindle had been assaulted outside Edinburgh, and where there was a lot of dirty protests, if you like, for the WP UK talks. So at this point, I was putting a lot of pressure on Essex University to ensure my safety and security should I drive 5 hours to give this 1 hour lecture. And I was also putting pressure on them to ensure that the people who wished to attend my talk could actually get in that talk without being harangued and harassed and bullied and hectored. And by the time we got to, I think it was 11, possibly 12, Nigel agreed that we had to pull the plug on the talk and cancel that lecture, because at that point, there was no way to get the appropriate security in place. Now, I have to stress this, and this is an important part of the narrative. When I was cancelled originally at Essex, the cancellation,
I just wanted to say that the talk that you mentioned where Julie was assaulted, that was Sina University, right? It was the University of Edinburgh, Julie Bindle, who is a feminist campaigner. She was assaulted outside of that institution. So when you say there are safety concerns, it was not hyperbole. It was a recent fact that feminists were being assaulted.
Yes. And, you know, of course, at that point, too, I think Helen Steele was tweeting about the anarchist book fair when one or two trans individuals assaulted an older woman. She was, you know, in her 60s. And I say that because, you know, we have to, if we recognize bodies, we have to recognize that older bodies can be a little bit more frail than, you know, somebody who's in their 20s. So to assault an older woman at an anarchist book fair, I think Helen herself was pushed out of that. Anyway, there was a lot going on at the time where feminists were being physically assaulted and manhandled, for lack of better words. So, yeah, my concerns about safety and security weren't just idiosyncratic. It wasn't me being just a little tender. They were real. So where did I get to, Raquel?
Well, you were saying that day there was a campaign essentially of vilification. I wanted to ask you, do you think that there was a decision to do it on the day of the event to sort of hype support for this campaign in a way that was coordinated to amplify sort of that message? It just sort of happens that someone realized, oh, there's this fact that is happening today with this academic, let's cancel it?
I think that everybody was caught unawares. I don't know. I actually can't answer that question. I've never thought about that, because what happened afterwards was far more devastating than what happened on the day. So let me just return to the story here for a second. When Nigel cancelled that talk, the idea wasn't that I would be disinvited. So not cancelled as in we understand cancel culture. That talk was in effect postponed until the appropriate security could be put in place. However, in the course of the week between December the 5th and December the 11th, the Department of Sociology, which is, if you like, the employing department for the people who are part of the Center for Criminology, decided to have a staff meeting in which they voted whether or not I should be blacklisted, right? As in disinvited and never allowed onto the campus again. In the course of that meeting, I have come to understand that a trans student appeared and told the academics how profoundly unsafe I would make the trans population feel if I were to appear on campus, in which other academics within that department and within the center said that had they known that I was such a transphobe, they would never have agreed to invite me, and in which fellow academics, people that I've known and worked with, maybe not directly, but you know, have we've been part of the same academic community, were going through my Twitter feed to vet my politics. Prior to that meeting as well, I was asked to supply a transcript of my talk, so that of my lecture, so that they could vet it for thought crime, in effect. Now, that to me is far more devastating than students wanting to protest a talk. You know, on the day, on December the 5th, everybody was caught unawares. I didn't want to go to a campus that didn't have security. My colleagues in the Center for Criminology didn't want an event to take place where there wasn't security, where it was clearly controversial or had become controversial. But by the time a week goes by, that space to keep the space open for discussion was absolutely shut down. And it was shut down by professional academics, not students. And that's the really important part here.
There's two elements here. And you said that you were caught unaware by what happened on December 5th.
Yeah.
But then something that I may want to add is, well, actually, the people who were targeting you, they were not unaware. You know, they knew what they were doing when they were hyping this sort of campaign of vilification around the woman who is an expert. So I think there's two elements. One is this very disturbing scenario in which your colleagues, fellow academics, are sort of questioning whether your thinking is correct, you know?
Yeah.
Like that kind of inquisition. And that's disturbing. But then the other element is, you just mentioned you're an expert. You've been working on this issue for over 25 years. Mm. The fact that either people who were in other fields, like historians, but also the fact that students were able to say, this woman is an expert, but my feelings are hurt by her talk, or whatever it is that they said, that in itself needs unpacking, because that's not normal, you know? And you know what? It's not normal, and it would not be respected if we did it in any other field. Like if I went tomorrow to physics departments, or to I don't know, nuclear engineer department and said, you know what? Like, yeah, you may be the expert on all of these particles and atom stuff, but I find this whole thing very offensive. I need you to cancel your talk. People would laugh at me.
Yeah,
you know,
they would certainly would.
No one would be issuing apologies. No one would be canceling an academic or sort of reprimanding an academic because I feel offended by their work. I think that what you're mentioning is, this is that there's another element an undercurrent between why it is acceptable to do this to you, even though you are an expert, and it would never be acceptable to do that same thing to any other expert in male-dominated fields.
No, and I mean, you know, one could argue, I don't know about the male domination within criminology, but if you mean in more traditionally scientific fields, then, you know, and of course those tend to be male dominated, then yeah, I'm going to agree with you entirely. And yet it also happens in other fields that aren't so male dominated. If you think about English and history, Selena Todd is a great example. I mean, the thing that I suppose the thing that really strikes me from that suggestion that you make there is that this 2.5 decades I've been doing this, and this subject and the manner in which both students and staff act when they are against what you want to say or what you want to do, is in my mind violence. And I don't mean that in that kind of literal metaphoric violence that, you know, people like me often get accused of. This is hectoring. It's shouting down. It's threats of violence. You know, one of the things that happened that Essex have never apologized for, and we can come to Essex's what they did after they so egregiously treated me. There was a violent and profane poster circulating, and I think it was circulating for the whole week. It was never taken down. It was never investigated. The poster accuses me of all manner of things, just about, you know, from you know, hating trans people to eating trans babies. It's, do you know what I mean? It's like, it is hyperbolic in its accusations. And of course, it's got the shut the fuck up turf with the, you know, with a cartoon image with a gun. You know, I've heard people talk about the fact that because it's a cartoon image, it's not that violent. It's just a cartoon. Well, bollocks to that, if you pardon my language. That is absolutely not the case. These posters, you know, anime as they are guaranteed and designed to intimidate, and intimidate because they rely on violent tropes. So it's the first time in my, I've wandered around here, Raquel, a little bit, but it's the first time in my academic career where I have been subject to the threat of violence. When I was talking to a very old dear friend about what was happening, it was back in 2019, she just kept saying the same thing. Why weren't the police called? You know, when the threats to blockade and harass and harangue, why did Essex never call the police? I'd like to know that question, or I'd like to know the answer to that.
Okay, so it's all very disturbing because there's something very profound happening in academia, and your example, well, your experience through this whole past year or 2 years, just demonstrates that there's something really rotten in the way academics are functioning when, instead of supporting the expert, you know, then she sort of gets something different, you know?
Yeah.
So we were talking about how, you know, there's an element of it in which the point that I was making is the sex and gender debate is mostly women who are the prominent voices, who are having these conversations. The campaigning groups are organized, you know, Women's Space UK, for example, is made by, made of the trade unionies, like women on the left.
Yeah.
But there's an element of, you know, all these women have experiences and expertise in areas that are relevant to this debate. But we, as the very entitled students, feel that we can shut them down because we don't like what they have to say. And they would never do that to a chemist who was who was 30 years into his career. You know, that's what I was trying to say. But then there's another flip side of that, and that is your academic colleagues, you know, like that meeting in which you're probing another person's thinking to see if that you find them agreeable when they're perfectly lawful opinions. And most importantly, they're your opinions as an expert based on the work that you did. It wasn't like you woke up one day and said, you know what, I want to talk about criminology, you know? That's just so bizarre. Did you lose your faith a little bit in academia at that point?
Look, at that point, I mean, it's been, you know, it has been, as you said, nearly 2 years. My faith, my understanding, my place in the academic world has changed so much in the course of the last 2 years. When this happened, I was furious. I mean, you know, proper, good, old-fashioned, righteous anger, because I thought all of that which you said, do you know what I mean? How dare they do this? This is against all of our professional ethics as academics. You know, it's anti-expertise, it's anti-academic. The one thing that universities should be for is debate, you know, and the one thing that social sciences should be for is to understand both the politics that are out there and how that relates to people's social experiences, but also how all of that relates to policy reform. I mean, the social world is our laboratory. So, you know, to me, it was so deeply offensive. It wasn't that it kind of lessened my faith in academia, although it has, you know, over the course of the 2 years. At that point, I was just really angry. Whereas now, I'd say that the academic world has fundamentally changed. from the world that I grew up in to this place now, where we have an entire, it's a cohort of students and academics who think that within social sciences, Raquel, and I want to come back to the sciences thing for a second, within social sciences, who think that their job is kind of like the equivalent of expose journalism, you know, which it isn't. You know, our job isn't to, you know, promulgate a particular political ideology and then expose, you know, all the instances where whatever group it is that you're supporting is done badly. Our job is to understand the conditions that make that happen, which is a different task. So, and in this world where, you know, students and academics are thinking that they're going to, you know, progress well if they but expose all of the elitists and, you know, the transphobes and, you know, whatever other politics it is that offends. In that world, those basic principles about what is knowledge, what is politics, what is our role, get shattered. Now, here's the thing, coming back to sciences. One of the reasons I think that social sciences and the humanities and liberal arts is a little bit different is because we don't deal necessarily in observable fact quite like scientists do. So, you know, you say it would be crazy going into, I don't know, a nuclear physics class and going, guess what? You know, particles don't exist. You know, it wouldn't, because within science, there is, you know, more of a trend to accept the notion of a fact, even though we recognize that if you pursue it long enough, those facts begin to fray in and of themselves. But, you know, within social science, it's like the world of questioning has fallen apart, you know, and all we're supposed to do is repeat the same mantras.
But the policies that we deal with in social sciences, like, they affect human people, you know, they affect real people with like flesh and blood, you know. So when you you submitted written evidence to Parliament regarding this topic, when you talk about, you know, there's evidence of self-harm in prisons and it's higher in a women's state, and there is evidence that women prisoners are more likely to be primary carers for young children, like, that is, those are facts, you know.
Yeah.
So when you look at that as your evidence to base your opinion that we need to protect single-sex spaces for women in prison, like, oh, that kind of stuff, when you do that, you're not talking out of conjuring that you came up came to you in a dream. It wasn't like something that came to you in a dream. It's actual evidence.
Quite. That's all I'm going to say. You know, this is why I say to you that, you know, this world is not a world I recognize and understand very much anymore. Because for me, I was taught by some of the best. My PhD supervisor was an amazing woman called Pat Carlin, who probably opened the field for women's imprisonment. You know, and she set up an organization along with others called Women in Prison. So, you know, I was you know, kind of taught by some of the best in the business. And so for me to now be shouted down because evidence no longer counts, instead what counts, you know, and forgive me for saying this, it's a phrase that people use, is the kind of magical thinking, you know, and that's if we say something is so, then it becomes so, you know, which is not how reality works. Do you know what I mean? I could say that my body doesn't matter, but I can tell you, Raquel, after 4 joint replacements and spinal fusion, my body does matter. It has a very real physical presence in this world, you know, and my journey through this world as, you know, a lesbian, as somebody who's disabled, as someone who's done research on this subject for, you know, a lifetime, my journey through this world, you know, how I think about it, it changes over time, but it doesn't change the facts of that journey. And I think one of the things that so deeply offends me about this moment in time is that you can't talk about facts without getting into a lot of trouble, quite frankly.
So before we move on, I want to ask if you could we talked about your meeting, which was originally postponed.
Yeah.
And then staff members decided that this just would not go ahead, right?
Yeah.
I wanted to give you an opportunity to very briefly explain to our Filia audience, what is it that you wanted to say that night of December 5th?
Well, Raquel, it's really...
A very short summary, though. A very short, summary.
Yeah, very, very, very simply. Introduce, off the basis of Canadian research, introducing policies of self-identification into a prison context, that prison context being one that is segregated by, you know, biological sex, creates massive problems. And it doesn't necessarily, not necessarily, suit the women who, you know, the females who are in the female estate, but nor does it necessarily provide the full range of rights for trans individuals who find themselves in prison. And that's the more, you know, that it's really important to recognize that just because we cater to somebody's subjective sense of themselves doesn't necessarily mean that that translates to rights and protections. So that's all I was going to say. Not terribly controversial, really.
But what's interesting is that if you don't get to speak, then some people can carry on the delusion that it's like, oh, well, everything's fine because no one's complaining. Yes, because you're silencing the people who want to object to it. You know, yeah, like that's right. The whole point, you know,
yeah.
If you're dealing with a political initiative like gender identity policies that depend on saying, well, no one has reported any problems. But then the facet behind it is that no, you can't hear those voices because the women who do want to speak out, who are experts such as yourself, the opportunity to speak out about it gets taken away. You know,
yeah,
and I imagine that as you, there must be many others, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I've got, can I read you a quote here? And you're going to say, you know, well, this is odd that I want to read a quote. This is from an article that I published about this issue. I published it along with a couple of other people, Rose Ricciadelli, James Gaycheck. I mean, we've got, and this is a participant to a piece of research. This is a prison officer talking about self-identification policies in the context of Canadian federal prisons. So this is, you know, from the mouth of the people rather than myself, if you follow. When asked whether, you know, placing people according to, you know, their biology could increase the risk for some trans prisoners. Now, one prison officer said, I don't know. I mean, there obviously needs to be a place for them, meaning trans individuals, but where that place is, I don't know. I don't think a woman should be in a men's institution, no less than a man be in a woman's. If you have all the working parts, meaning, you know, anatomically, which would enable you, I mean, women are going to rape women and men are going to rape men. So it's just going to happen. I just don't know. I think that that's going to come with a whole bunch of complications. Now, the point that I want to make there is when he's talking about women going to rape women, he's talking about trans women, and then men are going to rape men. He gets a little bit confused as he's talking about that. But, you know, the people who are on the ground actually having to do these policies and enact them know full well that actually we have to be able to talk about the complications. We have to be able to talk about potential violences. We have to be able to talk about, you know, the fact that there is a contradiction here.
So there are experts like yourself who are saying there's a lot of policy matters in place and we need to think about this very carefully. There are people on the ground who are doing direct services with people in prison, who are working directly with people in prison, and they are saying this is a problem. Meanwhile, you have this sort of, what do we call it? This sort of bubble of hysteria that is created to prevent both set of voices from being heard.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes, absolutely. Raquel, would it be helpful if I talked a little bit more about some of the challenges of putting, you know, biological males into a female prison?
Yes, if you want to, sure. I have your written evidence to the
Great.
Regarding the Gender Recognition Act. And I wanted to mention it, but if you would like to talk about it, that would be great.
No. You mention it.
You wrote your opinion and you wrote to the government regarding this reform of the Gender Recognition Act, which would have permitted self-identification of sex, in essence. And you talk about how community-based single-sex and separate sex provision for community services were created so that probation could address the different needs of women, and especially those needs that relate to the link between being victimized by men and criminalized women and criminalized women's offending histories. While never fully implemented, a report that you were citing, the one that was talking about how women are more likely to commit self-harm and their place in institutions, the prison state, which is built essentially for men, right? How that affects women, right? So you said, whilst never fully implemented, the Corson report still forms the basic framework for criminal justice provision for criminalized women on probation. Much of the day-to-day work now focuses on male-inflicted trauma, on adverse childhood experiences, on childcare issues, and the provision of basic social welfare. So this is the things that you wanted to talk about as an instead we get cartoons vilifying an academic.
That sums it all. I mean, I'm going to go back in history here, and it's going to be a little bit self-serving, so forgive me, please. When I said that I was supervised by the best, I came into criminology because of my interest about women who are both victims and offenders and how we deal with them. I originally wanted to do a PhD on women in prison, but Pat Carlin had just written her book. So, spoiled that one. And, Pat was hugely influential on my early thinking. And of course, we had no problem back in the 80s and the 90s and beginning in the 2000s, it became a little bit difficult, but we had no problem recognizing that the constituency of women who find their way into the criminal justice system are often more victimized than they are offenders. And most of their crimes, most of the women we're talking about who are in our criminal justice systems have these profound histories of abuse, at the hands of men.
The recommendation that you made to the Women's Equality Committee was, I urge the committee to provide explicit guidance on the importance of single-sex, women-only provision and spaces in the criminal justice system, including prison and community rehabilitation center in its reports and recommendations. You said, I also urge the committee to provide explicit guidance on the need to further develop policy, practice, and services based on respect and dignity for justice-involved trans and gender-diverse people's needs and requirements vis-a-vis rehabilitation and resettlement, but to do so in a way that does not impinge on the provision of single-sex, women-only services in space.
Yep.
Could you expand a little bit on this opinion regarding the rights of women in prison?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things we know, as I said, women who are in prison are in a very, they're a very particular constituency. And one of the things that research in the 1980s and early 1990s began to tease out was the fact that actually, there are no women-only prisons. Prisons who house females also have male officers in them. So we have to remember that. But there is something quite different about a female prison than a male prison, in that in female prisons, a lot of the issues that we're dealing with are welfare issues, self-harming and, depression and trauma-informed responses and so on and so forth. In male prisons, what we're dealing with when we try and create a well-functioning prison are, issues of security and kind of violence and things like that. I mean, there are a lot of welfare issues for men as well, don't get me wrong. But there is, much more of an effort at keeping people secure and not fighting with each other in male prisons than in female prisons. So one of the effects that we often see of putting women in women-only services, if you like, or female-only services, is there's the ability for those women to heal, for lack of better words, to come to terms with the violences that they've experienced, to express themselves about, you know, what's happened in their lives, and to be able to spend some time reflecting and thinking about how to move forward in a less law-breaking sort of fashion, or for them to be able to make connections between their identities. It's an interesting thing I want to talk about, but their identities as victimized women and how they're going to move forward in their life in a way that doesn't get them into trouble with the criminal justice system. Now, that's based on 2 centuries of research that tells us about these women's histories. Can we talk a little bit about trans people in the justice system? Well, we haven't really done much research about their needs, their backgrounds, and so on and so forth. We don't know a lot here, but we do know that for a lot of trans individuals, their experience of the justice process can be very denying of their trans identities, which is fine, or it can be quite punitive. So we do know, for instance, if you look at some of the policing studies, that young trans individuals will often be over-policed for their, you know, their kind of acting out in public places. We know, for instance, that, you know, they can be defined as doubly deviant and doubly damned in the courts. So not only have they offended the law, but, you know, as in criminal justice laws, but the manner in which they are made sense of is seen as being some sort of deviant. So we know those issues happen, but here's the deal. We don't actually know and cannot say. At this point, the research base does not tell us whether trans individuals, you know, let's say trans women, would suit the sort of woman-centered, trauma-informed regimes of rehabilitation and therapy that you see in, you know, that have developed up in the women's centers and you know, that are trying to be developed within female prisons. There's no reason to assume that that is the case. And in fact, if you look at the statistics, you know, thank you, Nick Williams, Fair Play for Women, who is, you know, an expert at doing all the FOIs and finding all of this information. We know there are approximately 160 to 170 trans identifying males in the male estate. So individuals who claim that they are trans women, who could, if we had a self-identification policy, move from the male estate to the female estate. We know that more than half of those individuals have committed one type of sexual crime against a woman or a child, at least once. So, you know, to put it fairly bluntly, we wouldn't have a problem saying people who have committed rape against women shouldn't be in the same sort of programs that are designed for rape victims.
Yes.
You know, I'm sorry, you know, and that's if that's transphobic, then, you know, I'm going to have to stand rightly accused of transphobia. In my mind, it isn't. That's simply a statement of fact.
But there is something so, there's a real element of power that is playing out in this conversation. Because if you think about it, women in prison, you know, they oftentimes don't have voting rights, you know, so their political power is very limited. So politicians don't really have an incentive to pay attention to the needs and interests of women in prison, right? But then there's an element of, you know, by the time a woman gets to the, ends up in prison, you know, there are multiple systems that have failed along the way, you know, including obviously in so many cases, male violence. There's something that is so grim about people who have not experienced this sort of issues and are not experts on these sort of issues. So they're not even letting the experts who do know about these issues speak out. But you're doing it from a position of, you know what, I'm a 22-year-old student in art, but I feel that I need to cancel, I need to bully and harass Jo Phoenix so that she doesn't give a talk, so that she doesn't express these opinions that are extremely important, that are about the interests of a group of women who are so disempowered in society. right?
Yeah.
So from that point of view, the power imbalances are mental, right? But then you add the other layer of, and the institution, the University of Essex, ends up condoning that sort of behavior, which is what ended up happening with the Reindorf report. And we'll talk about it in a second. But do you understand what I'm saying? There's like this added layers of like, this is so completely disconnected from me. I don't envision that I'm ever going to be in a female prison. So I don't really care about what happens to those women. When the expert wants to speak out, let's target her, let's vilify her. Meanwhile, this is something that will never affect me. And then instead of supporting the expert, the vice chancellor of the institution does this dance. There's no better way. There is no better. I have tried, like, how am I going to interview Joe Phoenix? I don't know how to explain what this man has done. But he's like, okay, so he does this dance in which at the end, he ends up saying, like, he condones that behavior.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so here we go. I think dance is the only way you can put it. I think that, you know, I'm going to refer to them by their first name, Anthony Forrester, Vice Chancellor of Essex University, and Aqua, who is Aqua Reindorf, the independent barrister who conducted the Reindorf review, and Bryn Morris being the registrar of the university. And since the apology has been offered, well, since I was first, you know, egregiously and unlawfully treated, Bryn Morris has been the main person who I have been in contact with. So, I think that they...
One second just, so that I can... Yeah. Could you give me just 1 second so that I can give the context for the people in the podcast who may not be aware? So
please, yes.
So as we mentioned, you know, there was this invitation, it was postponed, then it was withdrawn. Now in, I think it was May of 2021, 17th of May, 2021, there was a report conducted by a barrister, a discrimination barrister called Aqua Reindorf. The report was commissioned by the University of Essex to look into the events surrounding both Joe Phoenix and another professor called Rosa Friedman. So the recommendations that the end of this report is Professor Phoenix should be offered an open apology and an opportunity to give a seminar at the Center of Criminology. Or the recommendations are below. But essentially, it is a very long report, 108 pages, in which this barrister does a forensic examination into what went wrong in this university regarding these issues. And as a result of that report, the university made a statement in which they talk about academic freedom and how important freedom of speech was. And you were offered a public apology. My first question to you is, when did you knew that this report was being conducted? And when did you hear back about the incoming storm that was headed your way?
Right. Okay. I knew that the report was being conducted, and I knew the report was being conducted because from the moment that I got blacklisted, I jumped up and down and made all sorts of noises and complaints to Essex, and they came and told me, you know, they emailed me in the January saying that they were commissioning this report. I was then invited to give evidence. I gave, I think, 3 interviews of evidence to Aqua Reindorf and the university about what had happened to me. And then everything got kicked into the long grass. And by that, what I mean is everything seemed to just stop. So once a month, I'm going to interrupt myself. At this point, if we can go back, I'd never met Rosa, right? I still haven't met her, but I didn't know what had happened to her. I thought it was just me. So about once a month, I would send an email to Essex University and say, what on earth is happening? Because of course, you know, in this area, mud sticks. And, you know, I have had all sorts of troubles off the result of Essex. So it has damaged my career, quite frankly. I won't go down that route.
But something that is important to point out is that maybe if it wasn't because someone kept insisting, no, you have to address this. You're not going to just like push this under the rug. Maybe that's why they ended up having to take action, because I'm sorry, but like in my experience, they just kind of hope that you go away. Right?
Yeah.
Like they just tell you all these little things like, oh yeah, it's been like dealt with and we're doing this. And it's like, they just tell you things so that you can just like drop it. But then the thing with women who are campaigning on this issue is that we never drop it.
Oh God, no. And you know,
we never drop it.
You know, Raquel, all hats off to you. You are a PhD student. Am I right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I've got 25 years in the game. So a lot of, you know, my approach here has been, if I don't stand up, how on earth can I expect younger academics or indeed students to stand up? Because quite frankly, at this stage of my career, there's nothing a university can give me or take away. I have, you know, do you know what I mean? I have done everything that I set out to do career-wise. So if I can't stand up and be counted, then it's a sorry world that we live in. So let's come back to, I was pinging them emails. What's happening with this report? What's happening? Then we get to March of this year. March for me was a terrible, terrible month. I discovered that my mother was dying in America. I had to apply for an emergency visa to go and visit. I spent some time there. Whilst I was there, I had a crippling back injury, which required, you know, medical treatment. And meant that I, as soon as I could get back from America, I had to have spinal surgery. My mother died in towards the end of April. I got back from America on something like April the 28th, and I was scheduled for surgery on May the 11th. The next thing I heard after March was an email on May the 17th saying that the Rheindorf Review was being published. And I was out of hospital by 5 or 6 days at this point. I was whacked out on all sorts of drugs because I was in a lot of pain. And I had texts from Anthony Forrester asking to speak to me urgently, urgently. So, did I get given any thought about how being dumped into the middle of a media storm was going to play out in my life? No, Essex did not grant me the grace to give me any forewarning.
Wow, that's so intense.
Because
what we could see, what the public see is this report just came out, and I mean, I fell in love with Aqua. She's just so great.
yeah, with you.
No, you know, it's like we all sort of like, what the public could see from our point of view is this report is out. The university has taken a position in support of academic freedom and freedom of speech. And it seemed at that point, May 17th, that they were supporting women's rights to discuss these issues freely without being harassed, without being bullied, without being targeted, right?
Yeah.
But what you're saying is that from your point of view, you were going through something very different. You know, and the fact that you're not an employee at the University of Essex means that they can say, well, we had no duty of care to you. So what do we care about your spinal surgery? But there's a human element on it, you know? It blew up. This thing blew up. Meanwhile, at the end of this, there was a woman who was in a lot of pain, physical pain, you know? And grieving, obviously, grieving your mother.
Yeah. And what happened afterwards? So there were 10 days of life that I have never experienced and care never to experience again. Rosa reached out to me, or I reached out to Rosa. I can't remember exactly who. Or I think Julie Bindle put us in touch with each other, because I've known Julie for 1,000,007 years. So we got in touch with each other, and we decided very rapidly, once I realized that she had the same egregious treatment and she realized that I had, we decided that we would act in lockstep with each other, because the simplest way to make women like us go away is to divide and conquer. We agreed that we would only do joint interviews. We decided to talk about how to approach Essex. Rosa was a tremendous support to me. I mean, you know, she was undergoing her own surgery at the time, ironically, but she was a tremendous support to me. And she certainly knows how to play the media more than I do. You know, I've just been a boring, dull academic most of my career. So, yeah, we got dumped into an international media storm, gave interviews for Russian TV. That was a career first for me. Was on, you know, I mean, we were even interviewed for The Economist, and, you know, every single newspaper. And I mean, literally, the story just ran and ran and ran. And in the beginning, Raquel, I wanted to give Essex credence because I thought they were offering a genuine apology. And certainly Anthony Forster, the VC of Essex, had said in the personal telephone call to me that this was the beginning of a conversation, whereas it became evident over the course of the summer that that was not true.
Can we pause here?
Yes.
So you're talking about the media storm and people were asking to interview both of you. Yes, but at that point, the narrative was University of Essex supports freedom of speech and the academic freedom of people who want to discuss sex and gender issues. So that was the narrative then. So I'm assuming that, well, I read them, you were given interviews based on that assumption, right? You didn't know that there would be this second act coming up.
Oh, God, no. No. And in fact, you know, I grew up in Texas, there's an old phrase, might not be Texan, might be English, I don't know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. And, you know, in this case, you asked how I feel, aggrieved in the extreme, because I feel like I was hoodwinked by Essex University's promises or apologies. Because after that narrative, and I was happy to give I genuinely, hand on heart, Raquel, I was happy to give Essex some good press over this, because I genuinely thought that they would make good the invitation. I genuinely thought that we were going to start having a conversation, not so much about restitution. I don't mean that like, you know, they will pay a fine and they will do this. I mean, to broker and heal the damage that had been done in the best restorative justice fashion. I genuinely thought that the institution was up for that. But then I say we, because at this point, Rosa and I were acting in lockstep with each other. We both got sidelined by hearing about Anthony Forster's apology for the apology. And at that point, it was like, what on earth is happening? You know, has Essex become a basket case of a place? Were they lying to us? How on earth could this possibly happen? And if you read that apology for the apology, so I don't know, do you want to say something about that, Raquel?
I was going to ask you, well, I had the text from his original apology, but now I feel like I don't even want to grant him that. Like, that's how annoying I'm with this man. I just don't understand what he's doing. Like, why would you were supported, you receive all of the support from people saying like, at last, bravery in academia. And then you sort of, why?
Yeah, backtrack.
Why? Okay, but I wanted to ask you, did you, when in your conversations with the vice chancellor at the University of Essex, did you felt that you were being reassured and that it came across as genuine? Or looking back, can you think and see, well, they were only asking us to, they were only giving us this narrative so that we would go to the media and talk very well of them so that then they can deliver the second blow?
I have to admit, I know Anthony Forster of old. He and I used to work together at Durham University. And in fact, he may be even the person to say this, probably him better place to say it. He appointed me at Durham University. He was the chair of my interview panel. And you know, he and I worked relatively closely for a number of years. So when he rang, I believed him, and I was the one who, you know, I hate to say it in retrospect, but I tried to convince Rosa that he was genuine as well. So I feel a burden of guilt over that, because, you know, as it happened, no matter what Anthony says, Anthony is not Essex University. And I suspect that what happened after May the 18th was that holy hell let loose in the university, and that people were challenging the outcome of the Rheindorf review, that people felt that actually apologizing to us was, you know, basically giving a green light to transphobes and so on and so forth. And I think that's why he issued the apology. Now, for those out there in listener land who are listening to this, the apology for the apology came in a blog called Our Commitment to Our Trans and Non-Binary Staff and Students, in which Anthony says, my personal view is that the current law in the UK does not fully respect and protect identity of trans and non-binary people. I understand that in meeting our obligations to respect academic freedom and freedom of speech within the law, we have given the impression that we might not care about the lived realities, and so on and so forth. Well, to me, that second bullet point basically says, okay, yeah, so we apologize to these two women because we broke the law, infringed their freedom of speech, infringed our obligations for academic freedom, broke our public service legal obligations, and not only that, never bothered to investigate the violent profane poster against Professor Phoenix. So not only did we do all of that, but actually, you know, we did that. We've apologized for that begrudgingly, because actually what happens is that we haven't fully respected and protected trans people enough. So to me, at that point, that was a slam dunk. By the way, we take the apology away.
Of course. And it just, it's such a bizarre thing to say. As I mentioned, I'm so sorry, I'm being so petty. I wanted to read like quotes from his original apology and then the other, and he was like, you know what, you're not even worth it.
Yeah.
I'm not even.
Well,
but the thing, I mean, that strikes me is that, you know, yeah, when has a vice chancellor said, my personal view is that we should increase maternity provision for women who are in academia, like policies for women who are breastfeeding? When have they ever said, my personal position is that we really need to work to ensure that, I don't know, that women who have young children can have spaces on campus? Like, that kind of stuff, yeah, never happens, right? Why are, yeah, you doing this?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the vice chancellor. So let's think of him as the vice chancellor of an organization rather than an individual, because, you know, I have no doubt Anthony and I worked well together in the past, and I have no doubt that
Don't defend him.
No. I'm just pointing out that there is a history here, and that's one of the reasons I feel so aggrieved. But in addition to that, I recognize that he occupies a role within a university. So in his head, he may be saying, yeah, my primary orientation is with the University of Essex, not Joe Phoenix, right? Now, for me, the University of Essex can go jump quite literally, because, you know, I'm not their employee. They have broken the law, you know, and Bryn and Anthony have done nothing to heal the rift that happened. And when I say heal the rift, I mean make good their institution's illegal behavior. All they did was offer a piece of paper apology that is, as someone put on Twitter the other week, not even worth the paper it's written on, because it does nothing.
No, but more than that, it's not that you didn't address the policy issues that led to your rights, both of your rights, being violated, is that he sort of like created this chasm in which now every student who and staff member who targeted you feels emboldened, because, yeah, now they know, you know what, I can get away with it. And not only, yeah, that, but the vice chancellor himself is going to issue an apology for an apology. You know, it is a supreme act of cowardice from the institution itself, But there's an element of it that feels very undignified, in which I am asking, I am telling these women a tell, knowing that they're going to go on The Economist and Russia Today and whatever other in the Times and all that kind of stuff. They're going to do the media circle, circus, talking about how we respect their rights, so that then I can turn around and say, never mind everything that I've just said. Actually, our concern is with the people who targeted, harassed, and bullied those two professors. It feels very low.
Well, as they once said on a sitcom in the 80s in this country, yes, minister and yes, prime minister, you could say that. I couldn't possibly comment.
Yes, sounds fine. Yeah. Don't worry about it. But okay, so this happened, and then initially I think you accepted the apology, but then
we never publicly accept. I mean, that's the hilarious thing of all. You'd think, wouldn't you? In normal human relationships, when somebody apologizes, you check in with them to see if they accept the apology. You try and figure out if you need to do some more work around that in order for, you know, for everyone to move on past. Well, you know, that was never done.
Was it only a public apology, but not a personal one?
Oh, no, he personally apologized to both of us on those personal telephone calls because we had either more than an hour long conversation with Anthony separately, you know, me from my sick bed and Rosa just before she went into her sick bed. So, but I said there was one email that I sent, on the morning before I'd spoken to Rosa. And it was like, I think I'm minded to accept it, but I'm not sure. Right. Now, here's the deal. We have, you know, you may know this by now, last week or the week before, I can't remember when, Rosa and I put out a public statement formally not accepting the apology.
Because
the last installment in the saga is that the University of Essex had consulted several legal experts who redacted an awful lot of the report, including our personal data. So stuff about us in that report has been redacted. And I was happy with that. I was happy with that because one of the things that's in there are all the accusations that were made against me. Now, there've been a ton of FOI requests so that people can assess for themselves whether or not, you know, Rosa and I are or are not transphobes, and whether or not the apology was or wasn't warranted, and whether or not Essex did or did not break the law. So in other words, there's been a lot of pushback against Essex to try and, you know, they want to try it in public. And, you know, a lot of the people who stand by what happened to Rosa and I want to be able to say, oh, look, but these people are transphobes and the university didn't act that badly. And the poster was only a cartoon anyway. So why is she bitching? Now, all of that's going to be released, we understand, on August the 28th. That is against our consent. And we have expressly said that to the University of Essex, that we do not give consent for our personal data to be released. And, you know, I've had an email in which I have been, I want to say instructed, but that's not quite the right word, told that our consent doesn't matter, that legally, they have another obligation to square, and that's the obligation for freedom of information. And so they would like to get our comments. Now, I've said consent does matter, because if you're trying to heal the breach of something, if you're trying to bring people back into the fold and try and move forward, and you're genuine in your apology, then whether somebody consents certainly matters. And for me, you know, hey, I've been a feminist since I could eat, pretty much. Well, certainly since I was 18 years old. Consent to me as a woman is something extremely dear to my heart. So the fact that we have said, that I have said, I do not consent, and they've said it doesn't matter, says everything we need to know.
Well, that's all you need to know about their apology then. You know,
yeah,
but aside from the consent issue, I'm going to read a paragraph from the Reindorf report, in which discrimination barrister Aqua Reindorf wrote, as for indirect discrimination, the decision taken in relation to Professor Phoenix, that's the decision to postpone and then withdraw the invitation, may contribute mm-hmm. to indirect sex discrimination against women at the university on the basis that more women than men tend to hold and publicly express gender critical views. If that can be shown, it can be argued that women are more likely than men to be put at a disadvantage by a practice of excluding gender critical voices. While the university does not owe a duty to Professor Phoenix personally in discrimination law, pursuing policies of excluding gender critical external speakers might very well be of evidential value in an indirect discrimination complaint by a gender critical female staff member. So there's legal issues here, you know?
Yep.
There are legal matters that are yet to be addressed. And instead of clarifying, it seems that the position from the management of the university just like add more fire to it. It's like, just put more fire in the whole thing.
Yeah.
It feels like they just open a crater, you know, like that a big chasm has been created that is in a worse position than it was on May 16th before they published that report.
Can you imagine being not even a gender critical scholar, but just being somebody who wants to understand a little bit more and maybe someone who wants to talk with somebody who is a gender critical scholar? You know, imagine them in the Center for Criminology. I don't know if there is anyone, but imagine that there is somebody there who wants to do that. The context now at Essex is, I think, far personally, you know, I'm not there, but I think far more hostile than ever it was before. Ever it was. So I think. I mean, you know, who knows how this is going to play out, you know, and on one level, you're probably the last person I'm going to speak to. Well, no, I'm going to speak at the Center for Crime and Justice Studies. But, you know, I'm not going to speak about Essex a lot in the future, because for me, they've had enough of my professional life. They've had 2 years of my time and energy, and they have had an entire summer, and they interrupted the grief I had for my own mother and my own healing. So on one level, I'm like, I feel desperately sorry and desperately sad for anyone who is at Essex and who, you know, is a woman, who is a feminist, and who is interested in gender critical work, because that is probably the worst place in this country that they could be at the moment.
What did this experience taught you?
Oh, that's, no one's asked me that, Raquel. That's a really good question. It's taught me that you're only as good as the things that you stand by. And, you know, for as much as Essex has taken away from me, you know, I find myself, you know, towards the end of my career with a whole new set of friends. You know, that's, you know, I mean, really, you know, the second that I started reaching out to people, both from the past of my own personal life, but also professionally, you know, I have found an abundance of support. You know, Julie Bindle and I haven't always seen eye to eye about prostitution and sex work and things. But the second that I reached out to her, she's been there. Rosa's been there. All of the other gender critical scholars, you know, yourself. Twitter can be a vile, vile place, but oh my God, it can also be really, really supportive. So it's also taught me that universities have changed dramatically. And it's taught me that sometimes in one's professional career, I hate to say it, shit happens. And, you know, when it does, you've just got to figure out whether that's a raft you're going to jump on and ride out to the end. And I think that's where I am now. You know, I'm 57 years old and my career has had an absolutely new injection because, you know, people like me got to stand up. We've got to write about these things. We contain a memory and a history of both activism, but also research, you know, and we need to make sure that that history doesn't get lost. That was a really long answer, Raquel.
No, it's fine. I was just thinking that, you know, your work has reached an audience that it perhaps would not have reached before, you know, and that's an unintended consequence of whoever was doing cartoons and vilifying you that night on December 5th, you know? There's this assumption, you know, that if you speak out, your life will be sort of shut down, you know? Yeah. And there are very material consequences for the women who do speak out. But then at the same time, there's this window that opens.
Yeah.
And this window is there's a network, and there's a community and there's support, you know? It's like, there's so many people who come to me and say like, oh, I want to talk to like my best friend about how I believe that women are real and sex is real, but I'm worried about what might happen. And then I always say to them, you know what, all of these horrible things that you think might happen could happen, but also some very positive things could also happen. So your work is now being read far and wide in a way that perhaps it wasn't, or even like exponentially more than before that night.
I'm totally with you. I mean, there is a real paradox in all of this. We do end up, for as much as we get cancelled, we do end up with profile now, you know, and we end up in a place, that we never expected. And I'm speaking personally here, I'm using the royal we. I never expected to be here. And, you know, isn't it amazing? But I'm only here because, you know, I was egregiously treated. So if you were to ask me, was it worth it all? No, I would have rather given my talk, and I'd rather slowly build up that research base. And I would have rather slowly, kind of get involved in the politics and policy reform of things. And I'd rather have done things the way that I always did do. And that's, you know, in a standard academic way. But, you know, this isn't a bad place to be. It really isn't. I've got support. I still would like some sort of restitution. I don't know. A lot's been taken away from me. And, you know, as much as I have the support of colleagues and new networks, nothing can make up for the things that have been taken away from me. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it, Raquel? A real double-edged sword.
An apology or restitution, you know, that's not going to bring everything that was lost back. And no. I think that's something that was demonstrated by the University of Essex is that, you know what, women are being treated so horribly all over the UK by so many different institutions. And it's almost as if I have learned, at least in my experience, that that you sort of look up to this institution. No, everything's going to be fine. They will see the light. They will see that I should not be treated like shit. Everything's going to be fine once that moment comes. And I think that part of the process is just understanding, you know what, you don't need an apology from the institution that is violating your rights for validation. You know, it's like that apology doesn't validate you as a human being. And you shouldn't go to the source of harm to try to find healing. I'm saying, I don't know, there was an element when everything sort of broke out right at the beginning of like, wow, they are doing this report, they're going to be taking these actions, all this kind of stuff. But now it becomes very clear that they have zero intention in doing any of that. And then I think that what is the point of trying to get an institution to see that they shouldn't be treating women like crap, when at the end, what they will do is create some performance that they will then backtrack from. Because it's not genuine, you know? And then it comes back to what Aqua was saying, you know what, this could be discrimination against women. It's almost as if we're in this endless process of having to prove our humanity to the institutions that are abusive. And at one point, I think that, you know, it's better to just stop. Like, you don't need to keep proving your humanity to those institutions.
Well, Raquel, can I kind of end our discussion with two quotes, please?
Yeah.
I'm sure you've heard it. Audre Lorde, you know, the master's tools won't bring his house down. You know, trying to look for an apology and restitution from Essex. I mean, yeah, I would really like one, but, you know, that's the last place, because in point of fact, I think I don't know what's going on there, and I don't really care anymore, you know, but what they can't give me is anything that they took away by their illegal actions. But the other quote is a book title from the amazing, the stunning Angela Y. Davis. Now, she said, you know, freedom is a constant struggle. I've adapted that. Justice is a constant struggle. Since when did we as women ever think that we didn't have to fight fucking tooth and nail for justice, you know, in a context in which women are routinely denied justice? Now, by that, I mean straight across the board. You know, professors who are treated unlawfully, right the way down, you know, to women whose victimization isn't recognized by the courts. So for me, you know, you're right. You're absolutely correct. Looking for the, you know, remediation, for lack of better words, from Essex is a fool's errand. Go ahead.
Do you mind if I ask you one final question?
Please do, by all means.
How do you envision the way forward then? You know, I'm a student, you're an academic. How do you think that universities or people in academia can move forward from all the mess
from this place.
From all the mess that we have discussed in this podcast?
Oh, well, you know, I'm going to, you know, I have particular views. I have been a senior manager in universities, so I have a kind of different viewpoint about how we can produce institutional and organizational change. And by God, we need it. My own view is that we need to roll back on some of the ref metrics, particularly about impact, because one of the drivers of all of this is academics wanting to become almost celebrities to prove that they have had impact in their research. And I think that turns them more into activists than academics, and it turns people on Twitter into hideous social justice keyboard warriors. And by that, what I mean is people who are prepared to trash other people and other people's expertise on the basis of some preconceived notion of social justice and how that is achieved. I think we need to go back in our undergraduate degrees and start teaching students about professional ethics, because I think one of the things that universities no longer have is a sense of what is professional anymore. I mean, I've said this so many times, I feel like I'm a bleeding record, or a constantly going around record. And that's this. In my work as an academic, the research I do is as a paid employee. I am not a hobbyist. I don't do this because I want to create, you know, a particular outcome. I am paid as an academic. If my academic work can contribute to a wider debate, then that's great. But I am paid to produce knowledge. I'm not paid as a political activist. And if you could see me, I'm waggling my fingers all over the place here. So I think somehow we've got to help universities, and people like me can do it, you know, help universities understand that what we are in the business of is teaching and producing knowledge.
Not censoring it, not shutting it down.
Oh, absolutely not. Not censoring it, not shutting it down, but encouraging it. You know, I mean, I'd love somebody, you know, one of the problems that we have, because we all speak to you know, the converted at the moment, because we've been excluded from, you know, the realm of the non-converted, if you like, is that we don't have a chance to present our ideas in front of people who disagree with us. You know, and as an academic, I need the critique in order to be able to further my ideas and to communicate them better. So, yeah, we need to go back to being fucking professional academics, you know, and work with our networks and work with our activist communities. But we need to be academics first and students first, you know, and that means being committed to the open exchange of ideas. And committed to the production and dissemination of knowledge.
Well, thank you, Joe Phoenix, very much for speaking with us today. It has been very, we've learned a lot, you know, because there are perspectives, your perspective, your personal perspective have sort of like, that's not what we have seen so far. We have seen a lot of like the media headlines and statements and apologies and then non-apologies. But it's good to see the human element under all of that. So thank you so much for speaking with us and for the work that you do, most importantly, for the work that you do.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you very much for the invitation, for the podcast. And also, Raquel, for your lovely questions. You've made me think. And, you know, just thank you to all the people who are listening. And most especially, thank you for the energy and the work that you put into Philia.
Thank you, dear listener, for tuning in. We are incredibly grateful to all the women who donate their time and their effort to create this podcast. That includes our guests, our interviewers, and our editors. You can find us on your favorite listening platforms like Apple, Stitcher, and Spotify. Just search for Philia Podcast. Please help us reach even more women. You can do that by subscribing to our show, by sharing this podcast with your friends, with your family, and with your coworkers, and by leaving us a positive rating and review. Philia organizes the largest annual grassroots feminist conference in Europe. We would love to see you there. You can support our work by joining the Friends of Philia scheme, by giving a solidarity ticket so that even more women can join our conference, and by subscribing to our newsletter. Please take a look around our website, philia.org.uk, to find out more. Together, women make magic happen, and we can't wait to be in touch with you.